Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your attendance. We'll make a start. I think the quote of attendance is fairly complete. Welcome to another in our series of breakfast sessions on Michael Green's List B. This is the all-important planning and environment group on our list, and we have, it can be said without doubt, a very strong group of juniors and indeed silks on our list who are experienced in that field of law. The topic for today is what to do when VCAT gets it wrong. Now, one might think that that's a pejorative topic, even a confronting topic, that might suggest that VCAT often does get it wrong. The reality is, however, that because of its size, because of its turnover, and because of the demands on VCAT members to produce results quickly, it quite frequently does get it wrong, both in fact and in law. That's been my experience, having practiced down there for over 30 years. Putting that in context, however, it usually gets it right. It's composed, particularly in the planning environment field, with which we're concerned today and which I've been practicing in for that period of time, their decisions are usually very good, very well crafted. Their findings of facts are usually in accordance with the facts that the evidence and the facts that are presented, and their findings of law, when they're carried out by a legal member, and they're sometimes not, are usually upheld in the Supreme Court of Victoria. But the fact is, it being the largest judicial body in the state, it's by far the largest, it's larger than the Supreme and County Courts combined. I've forgotten how many members it has, but certainly more than the combined numbers of the judges of the County Court and Supreme Court. It's the largest state tribunal of any state in Australia. So therefore, inevitably, results will occur that will displease a litigant to the extent of that litigant wanting to take the matter by way of review or appeal or in some other way, and Sarah Porritt will touch on this, in some other way having a second think about the decision that's made, both on the law and the evidence. Sarah Porritt will be our first speaker. Sarah has, from my personal experience, an extremely strong knowledge and experience in the practice of planning environment law, not only in VCAT but in the Supreme Court on appeal, which is in effect the subject of our discussion today. She has her areas of practice are administrative law, the judicial review side, the merits review side of administrative law, commercial litigation generally with a particular emphasis on planning and environment, but has also appeared before a number of other administrative law bodies such as the Equal Opportunity Commission and Licensing and Disciplinary Tribunals. In that regard, she's been at the bar since November 2001, but been admitted to practice in 1994, which is a significant thing because those years of practice before the bar are very important in inculcating an experience in the barrister before they even reach the hallowed halls of Owen Dixon Chambers or elsewhere. She's been a sessional member of Planning Panels Victoria 2001 to 2003. She was a member of the Victorian Casino and Gaming Authority 2001 to 2004. She's was chairperson of the Planning and Local Government Committee at the Law Institute, which was part of her pre-bar career. She's a sessional lecturer in environmental law at Deakin University and an honorary lecturer at Monash University Legal Service at 1994 to 1997. Perhaps more relevantly and more current, she is one of the editors of what can only be described as the Planning and Environment Bible of Victoria, the Butterworth's Green Planning Environment Law Practice. And that of itself is virtually a separate form of career to that being a barrister, although a very good adjunct to it. So she brings a wealth of experience to the field. She'll be presenting a short PowerPoint presentation, I'm told, but will be addressing her paper, What to Do When VCAT Gets It Wrong. And interestingly, she covers not only the appeal, although the appeal procedure is the obvious first port of call, as it were, but there are other issues within the planning environment field which can be addressed as an alternative to appeal, and Sarah will also address those issues with you today. I call upon Sarah to present her paper and her PowerPoint presentation.
Thank you, Tony, and good morning. The paper, which I believe all of you will have by now, is called What to Do When VCAT Gets It Wrong, and I'll address it in passing. I'm certainly not going to read it to you this morning. I start with the observation that Tony has just made, which is that VCAT makes an awful lot of decisions each year. It's a tribunal that covers a vast number of different lists and makes decisions on a vast number of different topics. What we're concentrating on today, because this is part of the planning law series, is those in the planning and environment list. The VCAT annual report for 2010 to 2011 indicates that close on 87,000 cases were lodged with the tribunal in that year, and a similar number, about 86,000, were finalised. That's a huge number of cases. If you break that down then to the planning and environment list for that year, it records 3,775 cases as being lodged within the planning and environment list. I've taken from a paper given by Justice Greg Gard, the now president of the VCAT, a snapshot of the caseload. He's included here only the largest of the five lists. But what you'll see is, firstly, that the residential tenancies list clearly does a lot of work, and secondly, that the planning and environment list has a large number, but within the context of VCAT, by far not the overwhelming number of cases to be decided, but still a large number. What is then interesting is to compare that with the annual report of the Supreme Court for the same period. That records that there were 35 cases initiated within the valuation, compensation and planning list, and that 16 were finalised during that year. Now, not all of the cases that are reported in the Supreme Court's annual report as being within the planning and the valuation, compensation and planning list are going to be appeals from the planning and environment list. That list is going to include a number of compensation matters which can be referred directly to the planning and environment list. And in that year, there are a couple of cases which are not appeals but have similar factual situations, like the Wheelerhan case, which concerned the Casey Tip, which I think a number of people will be familiar with. I think the Love decision, which is a compensation decision, was working its way through the courts in that period of time. So it seems to follow that there is an extraordinarily small number of cases that make its way into the Supreme Court's planning and environment list compared to the number that are decided by the tribunal. I have to say that when I looked at those figures, it seemed very low. I don't know the breakup exactly, but I'm not entirely surprised that it's a small number. It's probably consistent with what we as practitioners see, which is decisions coming out maybe once or twice a month within this area, but not more frequently. So it follows that the expectation sometimes of clients that if something goes wrong at VCAT or they don't get the decision they want, that's all right, I can just appeal it to the Supreme Court, is not something that is consistent with reality or expectation. So I've tried, as well as dealing with some of the issues relating to Supreme Court appeals, which is your obvious thought, to think of a couple of other things that tend to occur and perhaps reasons why you don't see as many matters going to the Supreme Court as certainly I might have expected. And I've addressed there the three matters I'm going to address. So firstly, the slip rule, which is in some senses surprisingly important. The option of reapplying and going back and making a fresh application. And I think in reality that's often what happens when people are disappointed by the result. Not so much a disappointed, say, objector who's objected to a planning permit application. They don't really get a second bite at the cherry, but certainly if you're acting for a permit applicant, often the most effective way is to go back and try again one way or another. And the third matter I'll be addressing is appeals to the Supreme Court. And Mr. Walker and I have divided the seminar in the sense that I'm doing the mechanical parts, and Mr. Walker is going to address the issues about grounds and the basis for appeals. Looking first then at the SNP rule, I've set out at paragraph 9 the text of the SNP rule. It's not overly exciting to read out. It is, as you would imagine, the power that allows VCAT, as there are in many courts, to amend an error that's made a clerical error or an accidental slip or an omission. I had a look at the VCAT or the Austria reported decisions for VCAT last night, looking at, well, what sort of things is it used for? Is it frequently used? And interestingly, as of today, the first 5 decisions on the website, and this is not typical, are all corrections of decisions. So I've just set out a couple here to give you a sense of the sort of things you can ask for a correction for. Not particularly clear how this particular one arose, but there was a notation in relation to an existing dwelling which has been changed to accommodation, and that's simply identified as a typographical error. It looks minor, but it might be that that's very important. If your client needs a permit for accommodation and the order doesn't give it one, that might, over time, be a highly significant matter. The next one concerns a development contribution levy. What appears to have occurred is at the end of an ordinary case, the council will bring along the conditions on which the permit is to be granted. One of those is frequently under the planning schemes a particular development contribution amount. I can only imagine that the council officer was feeling a little bit sheepish when they got back and discovered that they'd forgotten to ask for a development contribution. The tribunal made the correction and it noted that it wasn't given within the without prejudice conditions notification that they wanted a development contribution. It seems to me to be perhaps towards the outer limits of what I would have expected to be picked up by the SLIP rule. It's certainly, I suspect in that case, a statutory requirement under the overlay that contribution be made, and the tribunal's been happy enough to pick it up as a correction order and made that correction. The next one is one which it was actually a matter I appeared in, and the tribunal had left specify street in its conditions in its order, which was just slightly embarrassing. Council went back and said, look, there's a few things you need to fix up. And duly they did. And then there is a fourth one where a number of what appear to be reasonably substantive things have appeared within the reasons for the order, and the tribunal has said, well, you know, it's important and we're going to make a condition for this and a condition for that. The planning consultant has gone back to the tribunal at the end of the day and said, well, you said you were going to have all these things as conditions and you didn't manage to actually record them in your order. And in those circumstances, the tribunal again has issued a corrections order to pick up on those matters. You'll see it's a fairly wide range of things that can be covered in corrections orders. It seems to be something that the tribunal is more and more willing to engage in. I recall being involved in a matter some years ago, it was probably almost 10 years ago now, where we got back the order and much of the debate had centred on a particular part of the car park, which was on the west of the site. The tribunal order came out and it described what needed to occur on the east of the car park. And it was particularly to do with a tree and what had to be done in relation to a tree. There were trees on both sides of the car park. And the council said, no, look, we're not prepared to amend the order or endorse plans that are consistent with what the tribunal meant, because they said something totally different. And they wouldn't consent to us making an application for a corrections order. So my client had to wait something like 5 months to go back before the tribunal, who walked in and said, oh, did I get it wrong? Okay, all right, I'll amend the order. And so she did. But we lost 5 months in the process. I suspect that that might not occur now, or at least I like to think it wouldn't. It was before the days of directions hearings, so at very least, you'd think you'd get it on a little bit quicker. But it's quite a powerful way of going about things, and often a worthwhile one, and also a good reason when you get a decision to check it very carefully, because, as Tony has quite rightly said, there's an awful lot of decisions made. They're often made quickly, and under time pressure, you often do see small things creep in that might be fundamental or important to your client, and it's worth checking, and it's worth bringing it to the tribunal's attention to see if you can get it changed. You need to notify all parties, and the way that it's most likely to occur is if you can get consent of all parties, and quite often that occurs reasonably readily. The next way that you might go about dealing with an adverse decision is to consider making a new application. And frequently, when you consider all the matters that Andrew and I are going to talk about today, you might well take the view that the sort of time, the sort of expense, and the sort of lengths that are required to review a decision, even if you think you can identify a question of law, and that's frequently not a self-evident proposition, it may still be worthwhile considering just going back and having, I shouldn't say having another go, but asking for same or similar remedy or permit to what you initially wanted, but changed a little. In doing so, you need to be careful of what is referred to by the tribunal as something called the repeat appeals doctrine. I set out a quote there from a decision of the tribunal, which is quite a neat summary of what's meant by the repeat appeals doctrine. You frequently get people saying the tribunal can't consider repeat appeals. It's not strictly true, and part of what the repeat appeals doctrine is about, unsurprisingly, is trying to stop people from forum shopping. There was, I believe, before my time, a tendency for people to try and seek adjournments or wish to ensure that they got their matter considered by a tribunal member who they thought was best likely or most likely to make a decision that favours their client's interest, for want of a better way of putting it. It's a practice which the tribunal very strongly frowns upon, and part of the reason for not wanting repeat appeals is that they don't want a situation where people are coming back time and time again just hoping that to try their luck, see if they can persuade a different person to a different view. It's also why you quite often find, if you're having a second hearing in relation to the same property, that you'll find yourself back before the same member, and that's something administratively that appears to occur reasonably frequently. What this decision says is that there's nothing to stop someone from coming back. You can come back, in fact, with the same application. What you face, though, not unreasonably, is it's not really a doctrine, it's more of a practice that if either the council or the tribunal has made the decision once, you really need a change that the applicant can show that warrants a different decision. And sometimes you get a change in the planning scheme and that might be enough, but sometimes a change in what's actually sought. The point is made that the tribunal isn't bound by its previous decisions, but it is going to give them weight in reality, and you will need to show that something has changed. But even so, it's frequently an expeditious way of getting another chance to have your permit or to have whatever it is that your client's wanting. The most obvious way, or the way that always occurs to people when they have an adverse decision and they want to consider it, is Section 148 of the VCAT Act. I've set out at paragraph 17 the provision that provides that right of appeal. There's a few things to note about that provision. And interestingly, it misses the first part. That What it says is a party to a proceeding may appeal on a question of law from an order of the tribunal in the proceeding. What is provided in other parts of the Act is indeed you need leave of the court before you can appeal. It's only a party to a proceeding that can appeal, and occasionally you get people who will see a decision who might have a particular political interest or interest in an area generally who say, gee, that's a terrible decision, can I appeal it now? That right of appeal is limited to parties, and sometimes that's important. You occasionally get people who've been involved on the periphery but not in fact decided to be parties trying to appeal a decision that's not open to them. The proceeding, interestingly, is defined to include both the final hearing but also mediations and some of the interlocutory steps, although there are issues about appealing interlocutory orders rather than final orders. Leave is required. An appeal is available both from the order, and order is defined as including the reasons. So sometimes what's in the reasons is actually more important to your client than what's in the orders. There is an appeal available in respect of those. The right of appeal is available only on a question of law, not on a not simply on the merits of the decision. And the error must be what's called a vitiating error, which means it must be capable of affecting the outcome of the case such that a different result might have ensued. So quite often you'll get a decision back, and I shouldn't say quite often, but it certainly happens, and you'll look at it and go, that's just not quite right. That's, yeah, the way in which they've described the area of land or some aspect of it is simply mistaken. That's as it is, but it's probably not a vitiating error, unless you can say that that misdescription fundamentally affected the way the tribunal went about its job and that it got it wrong. I've set out there some mechanical provisions, how to make an application. You've got 28 days. That will frequently feel like a very short period of time. The 28 days starts from the date of the order, and frequently in practice you don't actually get the order until, in a recent case I was involved in, 9 days after it had been made. That 28 days can feel like a very short period of time in which quite a lot of work has to be done. You then have a series of documents that are required to be completed. There's an originating motion, which is simple enough. And the affidavit in support, which is frequently a lengthy document, and what's generally done is to set out what happened at the tribunal and attach frequently voluminous paperwork associated with the expert evidence, the materials that were tendered in the case, extracts from the planning scheme, and it's usually quite a difficult and laborious task to put those affidavits together. Part of the reason I say that 28 days can feel like not a long period of time, you then serve a summons, and that summons is returnable generally in the planning and environment list before the judge of the relevant list. The rules will tell you that it's returnable before a master, but because of the workings of the specialist list, it'll generally be returnable on a Friday, on the practice day, before the judge of that list. I've set out there what an affidavit in support must do. Again, it's a reasonably lengthy recitation of what occurred, the facts, the material circumstances, and you need to attach a copy of the decision and various other matters. Unless your point of law is very tightly confined, and occasionally it is, occasionally it's simply a statutory construction point, but even then, there's an expectation that you will produce a transcript of the VCAT proceedings. In reality, in terms of time, they often can't be produced within 28 days, and it's acceptable and pretty common practice that a supplementary affidavit is served when the transcript becomes available. I've set out there the time limits that apply. Again, it's 28 days, whether or not you're appealing to the trial division or in the case of a decision made by the president or a vice president, that application for leave or appeal goes straight to the Court of Appeal, which indeed are the matters addressed at paragraphs 30 to 31. I've then addressed the principles to be addressed in terms of deciding a matter for an application for leave. They're set out in a reasonably early decision under the VCAT Act of the Department of Premier and Cabinet and Hulls. There are many decisions since, but Hulls is probably one of the best summaries of the sorts of things that can be important. Obviously, you need to identify a question of law. Obviously, it must be relevant to the relief sought. There's no point having a question of law that actually doesn't particularly progress your client's case. So yes, they got it wrong, but that wouldn't actually lead to a different decision. That's not going to be worth appealing and you probably won't get leave. One of the interesting things at the leave stage is an important matter is whether or not the matter is of general public importance. You might well get leave on a case that it's not as strong as others if it raises a matter that's frequently dealt with by the tribunal and the court takes the view, look, if there's an error going on in these sorts of applications or in relation to this sort of issue, we need to correct it, and you might well get leave on that point. You don't need to establish at that stage that the tribunal in fact got it wrong. You just need to establish that the decision's attended by sufficient doubt. So it's obviously a lower test. It must be just to grant leave. That's going to depend on the circumstances of the case. And there must be a sufficient injustice in terms of leaving the order unreversed. That's going to be easier to show in relation to a final order. It's often harder in respect of an earlier order. There's an appeal from a decision to grant leave from a master to a judge and from a judge to the Court of Appeal, although that's a fairly murky and difficult area. If the appeal's granted, you've got 14 days to institute the appeal. It's amazing how often the actual filing of the notice of appeal once leave is granted is actually forgotten, but it is required to be filed within 14 days. There are certain things the notice of appeal need to set out. You will have already drafted your notice of appeal in anticipation of getting leave, and it's exhibited to the affidavit, so that work should already be done. And occasionally the judge will say, you can have leave on A, B, C and D, but I'm not giving leave on E and F, so you might have to amend it. There are then some mechanical provisions in relation to the filing of leave. In terms of the hearing and determination of the appeal, one of the things that's worth bearing in mind is that quite often the court will not make a decision that finally determines your client's rights. What they will do is send it back to the tribunal, which is the arbiter of fact, to make the final decision. That has an important effect in terms of deciding whether or not you wish to appeal. Because what your client is facing when they lodge an appeal is, in many cases, a situation where they need to have a leave to appeal hearing, followed by an appeal hearing, followed then by the referral of the matter back to the tribunal, and then waiting for a further hearing of the tribunal. And the timing in relation to these things differs enormously. I was considering this morning, I've been involved in a matter that's been appealed that was heard just before Easter. It turned out that the council didn't consent or oppose the application when it came on for hearing before the Supreme Court. We got a date on the very first directions day in view of the council's attitude to the matter. We asked that both the leave and the appeal be heard together, which they were. We were accommodated happily on the very first day that would normally have been a directions day. The appeal took a couple of hours to hear, and Her Honour gave us a judgment in, I think, late August. So we managed to get through the whole of the appeals process in about 4 months, which is pretty extraordinary for something that didn't have particular urgency. My client still has to wait to go back to the tribunal to have that heard again, but that's a pretty expeditious hearing. By contrast, I was just looking at the dates earlier of another matter that I was involved in, which started with the directions hearing in 2008. In August of 2008, we had an agreed statement of facts. It was reasonably contained in that respect. And having been to the Supreme Court, been referred back to the tribunal on what at that stage was thought to be a pretty simple decision to be made by the court. There were then, I think, two directions hearings, a final hearing and a final set of further submissions after that. We got a final order in February of 2011. It took about 2.5 years. It wasn't in that case as big a deal as it might be in other cases, because what was sought was an enforcement order to stop bicycle track from operating. They operated throughout the period, and eventually that declaration enforcement order was not made, so the timing wasn't as critical. But if you've got a client who's paying holding costs on land, that sort of delay is sometimes a big issue, and part of the reason that, as I said at the start, it's often worth considering whether a more expeditious way maybe to go back to the tribunal with a similar application. And what I've said in conclusion is that in some ways the moral of this paper may be less about how to correct mistakes and more about the need to be vigilant to ensure that they don't occur in the first place. And that, of course, is something we have some, but not total control over at the tribunal stage. Thank you.